On episode 449 of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Dr. Nir Barzilai and discuss his book, Age Later, Health Span, Lifespan, and the New Science of Longevity. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/449. Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go. This episode of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is sponsored by Usual Wines. Some nights it's really nice to have a great glass of wine, but opening a bottle means drinking more than you wanted or pouring much of it out. Or maybe you're like my wife and I, she prefers sparkling while I like reds. That's okay if we're at a restaurant, but not when we're at home. Usual Wines has solved that problem. They make a red blend, a rosé, and a sparkling white wine, Brut. They also have a limited production Brut Rosé just for the summer. All available in single-serve 6.3-ounce bottles. And even better, they add no sugar or additives. These dry wines are low-carb. That means zero sugar, lower in calories, and have none of the chemicals that cause some people problems. They make a truly clean wine with grapes from world-class American viticulture areas in California like Napa, Sonoma, and Santa Barbara. Check Usual Wines out at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/wine and use the discount code FITNESS for $8 off your first order. 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/wine and get $8 off with the discount code FITNESS. Enjoy. Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to let you know that we have some really exciting news here at 40 Plus Fitness. I spent much of this weekend revamping the website, 40plusfitnesspodcast.com, and I'm really happy with the changes. You can check it out at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com, and I'd appreciate any feedback. You can either email me, alan@40plusfitnesspodcast.com, or you can click on that little blue lightning button thingy at the bottom of the page, and that'll let you message me on Facebook. I'm also launching a 40 Plus Fitness blog. This blog will focus on things I'm doing to improve my health and fitness, and I'm hopeful it will help you with your journey. You can also find that at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com. But that's not the most exciting news. It's a little too early for me to let the cat out of the bag, but if you want to be first to know what's going on, what's coming up, you should join the 40 Plus Fitness Facebook group at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/group. It's a really cool group. I post, you know, inspirational things. We have weekly challenges, and you'll be the first to know when we make this huge announcement that's coming up really, really soon. Our guest today is the founding director of the Institute of Aging Research at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Nathan Schock Center for Excellence in the Basic Biology of Aging and the Einstein-Glenn Center for the Biology of Human Aging. He is also the science director of the American Federation of Aging Research, AFAR. He discovered the first longevity gene in humans and has since discovered several others. And he's the co-founder of COBAR, a clinical stage biotechnology company that is focused on increasing the health span by developing treatments for age-related diseases. In this episode, we're going to discuss his book, which is his first, if for public consumption, called Age Later. With no further ado, here's Dr. Nir Barzilai. Dr. Barzilai, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Nice being with you.
Now, your book, Age Later, Health Span, Lifespan, and the New Science of Longevity, is obviously a topic that I think more and more as I age, it's just kind of one of those things that just sticks out. It's like, you know, I see people living to their 90s to 100 and plus. I was watching a show on Netflix the other day called Old Guard, and they were effectively immortal until for some reason they weren't. But you're talking about people in this book that are almost immortal. I mean, they're living 40% longer than the average. And that's incredible. And if we're going to live that long, obviously we also want to have the health span to go along with that. So a lot of good stuff I want to pull out of your book, and I really appreciate the opportunity to review it with you.
Sure.
Okay. So you got interested in aging. You're talking about meeting up with your father. You were walking with your father.
Grandfather.
And he got really tired walking up a hill, and that kind of got you at an early age thinking about aging. And in your study, as you got older, you know, you're actually studying this topic, you identified a term you call superagers. Can you define superagers and some of the traits that you found in people that live for a really long time?
Well, let me just go back and say that in the field of aging, we call it geroscience. We made really great strides because we kind of ignored the fact that it's really very complicated when you look at the components. But it's less complicated when you look at models that seems to age longer, to age slower, I mean, and to have an increased health span. And there are models like that in nature. And once they were discovered, once you could do and imitate some of the findings in genetic ways, it became much, much more achievable. And we understand now that aging is flexible and we can target it. And the reason I went to the centenarian at the same time where those genetic components have been discovered and very exciting models was because I thought, you know, let's go to humans who live 100 years old, because they lived, as you say, they lived 40% longer than their cohort. You know, now people are living longer anyhow, but we're not living to age of 100. And ask, what are the reasons for their slow aging? And that's why we got them. And in order to be in my study, basically, you had to be healthy at age 95. Now, if you're 112 and in coma, you still make it because it's the genetics that we're after, okay? And we wanted to find the genetics component of exceptional longevity. But being healthy and living independently in 95 showed that no matter what, they've exceeded their health span by a lot compared to other people. And that's our definition of the super agers.
Okay. Now, you found a few traits that are fairly common amongst the super agers, dealing with cholesterol, growth hormone, and I'll be honest with you, the last part of that, you got a little over my head in the science.
Yeah.
But can you talk about those traits, what they are and what they mean?
Yeah. So for example, when we started looking at the centenarians and doing just kind of routine tests, one thing that was really remarkable is that they had high level of the good cholesterol, of HDL cholesterol. It actually ran in the families. It's kind of complicated because the good cholesterol goes down. When you look at a certain individual longitudinally, okay, you take the same person, the HDL every year, every 8 years will go by five points. So basically, 100 years old, their HDL should be like 20, but it wasn't. It was normal. When you look at those data cross-sectionally, when you look at population, it doesn't change with age. It's 45 for men, 55 for women. So how can you explain that in individual it goes down and in centenarians it's the same? Well, if this is a longevity factor, if this protects you against dying, then the people where it goes low, they die, and the people with high level maintain the high level up. And this is kind of what we've discovered in our centenarians. So they did have high level of HDL, which made us ask, well, what is the genetics of that? What are the changes in genes that they have and others do not have that explain this high level of HDL in their families? And we found a couple of them that proved to be not only interesting, but they're it was kind of realizing the promise, because in each case, a drug was created for them, one by Merck and one by another pharmaceutical called Ionis. So it really was a proof of concept that was really interesting and important.
Okay. And now the second trait you talked about was human growth factor.
Right.
Particularly the IGF-1.
So again, one of the first thing that was discovered in nature and in genetics is that the animal models that have the animal dwarfs in many models, they live long. Even the nematode, when you take out the nematode worm, when you take out the growth gene, they live much longer. The little dogs live longer. The ponies live longer. And when you mutate many of those growth genes, you get an extension of health span and lifespan. And I actually thought that that's probably not going to be the case in humans. But, you know, when you write a grant, you come up with hypotheses. You don't care if it's true or not. My belief had nothing to do here. I was convincing that I should get the money to do it. And we found out that it is very important. In fact, more than 60% of our subjects have mutations or changes in the growth hormone pathway. The growth hormone pathway, there's more than one gene. There's, you know, about growth hormone, but there's another gene that's very important that's called IGF-1. That's what growth hormone does when it binds to the liver. It increases growth IGF-1. And then this IGF-1 has its receptor, and growth hormone has a receptor. So there's a whole pathway. And this pathway is impaired in our centenarians. And so we think that actually, look, it's, you know, to explain simply the theory here is that at certain point, you have to change your energy from growth to defense, okay? Now you're playing defense. You have to stop this growing and you have to start pointing the energy to do something else, like stop the genetic breakdown. Stop the breakdown, basically. And so people who are already tuned like that are aging just later.
Okay. So, you know, the big anti-aging movement has people taking testosterone, and in some cases, they're also taking growth hormone. But in fact, that might actually be shortening their lives.
Right. And I would add estrogen for women in this case. Look, we were rushing. And by the way, I was there at this camp initially. You know, I when I came to aging, there was no aging, not much of aging. There are several people who had hypotheses, but there is no really big science of aging. And I thought, well, I should be an endocrinologist, because one thing is clear, all those hormones are going down, which means let's just replace them, and that's how we'll do aging. And it turns out that it's almost the opposite, because look, when you have the breakdown of aging and you're seeing lots of things, some of them can cause aging, there's no doubt. Some of them maybe don't play any role, at least in our lifespan, but some of them may be protective. After all, when you start to have this breakdown, just like you have infection, you have inflammatory response, when you have a breakdown of aging, you have a response. By the way, some of this is inflammation too. So it's not as simple as to say, oh, it's high, we'll lower that, or it's low and will increase it. It's not like that. And I think the best, all the examples that you gave are really good, but you know, the estrogen was such a controversy. I mean, some people say, why the Women Health Initiative even went to estrogen? We knew it's going to be good. And now that it's bad, people are saying, well, maybe, you know, maybe, no. It's not what it is. Maybe there's other explanation. And they basically focusing on the fact that if you give estrogen between 50 and 60, maybe at that point you get some benefits. But still, the women who are older than 60 didn't do well in estrogen. So it's going to get to them, okay? And it's kind of the same with testosterone. I mean, no matter how we looked at testosterone, the risk outweighed the benefits. And growth hormone is a really open area because there's a lot of business in growth hormone. And lots of elderly people are getting growth hormone. And in the meanwhile, I'm discovering by totally unbiased way that probably this is not a good idea to give growth hormone, okay? Because it's the opposite. If you have low growth hormone, you're much more protected. You can live healthier and longer. I would say just one thing to be aware of. This effect of growth hormone is huge in females and not as much in males, both in animals and humans. In other words, growth hormone injections might not be as risky for men as they are for women, but we're not sure of how risky it is, you know, what is the magnitude of this effect. So there's a little openness here, but be careful.
Yes. And then when you got into the mitochondria, I think you did lose me a little bit there, only because it got pretty detailed, but can you kind of go into, you know, the mitochondria does a little bit more than just provide energy in the cell. And the things you're finding is that that's part of what's causing the aging or the slower aging.
Right. So, yeah. So let me describe the evolution of that. Okay. Once upon a time, many hundreds of million years ago, there was the initial cell, and the cell had a real problem. The cell had a lack of energy, could do only glycolysis. There's not that many calories from glycolysis. And the cell was also exposed to oxygen, which is very toxic. So there was the cell, but next by, the mitochondria was walking. And the mitochondria is really a bacteria that can do two things, can harness the oxygen and also make energy out of that. So that's how the cell got the mitochondria, okay? So this mitochondria is a collaboration of a bacteria and the cell to make it better. And it was felt that in this marriage, the cell really was calling the shots because a lot of the messages came from the nuclear genome, okay, from the nucleus of the cell, right? And what we kind of discovered is a new biology that really showed that this mitochondria has hundreds of its own messages. And so there's a crosstalk, not only between the nucleus and the mitochondria, but those peptides that are being manufactured by the mitochondria are exiting and they're influencing other effects across the body. And they're known as mitochondrial-derived peptides. So yeah, you know about the mitochondria and the powerhouse and the fact that mitochondria declines with aging and that it's associated with lots of diseases and we really need to make sure our mitochondria is okay. But there's another aspect of the mitochondria, which is the messages they have. And I have a company that I founded with my co-founder, Hasi Cohen, who's the dean of USC School of Gerontology. It's COBAR, where we are actually making therapy out of those peptides that are basically offering resiliency against many of the diseases of aging.
Okay. So these are traits that we would have. You know, if we're looking at our own aging, there's seven, what they call, I guess, hallmarks. You didn't identify these, but you mentioned them in the book. So kind of like the areas where your field looks. A couple of them that I was really, you know, I was obviously familiar with and you've gotten into already is the epigenetics, but also inflammation and a few others. Can you kind of go through those and why looking at all seven of those is important?
Well, by the way, I have eight there, but you know, we had seven initially, the Europeans had nine, then Brexit happened, you know, you know, those hallmarks, we initially thought to call them the pillars of aging. And then we said, you know what? We still are gathering data. It's going to change. And if you all of a sudden take a pillar, the whole building would collapse. So let's not call them pillar. Let's call them hallmark. But in fact, I'm using much more another term, which is knobs. Because what makes a hallmark hallmark is the fact that there's a good research that shows that if you intervene then, you change health span and lifespan. Okay? That's really the evidence. Another thing interesting, those hallmarks are interconnected in the sense that you can target one of the knobs and it's going to influence the others. So I'll give you an example. One of those hallmarks is called proteostasis. What is proteostasis? We are manufacturing, and with aging, we're manufacturing an increase amounts of proteins that are just wrong. They're not folding right. They're accumulating. They're doing traffic jams. and they're causing lots of problems. Now, there's a way to deal with it. There are several ways to deal with it, but one is called autophagy. Autophagy is the garbage disposal of the cells, okay? There is ability to garbage dispose that is decreased with aging. But by the way, it's a green energy garbage disposal because it gets those proteins or whatever garbage, takes them to little components that can be recirculated for energy again. Autophagy, by the way, is eating yourself, but it's not really eating yourself. It's cleaning yourself and making available better body. So when you turn on autophagy, which you can do genetically or by drug, you get effect on the mitochondria, you get effect on the metabolism, you get effect on immunity, okay, other things. Another thing, two of the hallmarks are decline in immunology, in immune function, and also inflammation, or as we call it, inflammaging. Those are the really two things that are relevant now to COVID. And let me make a point out of here. COVID, so I'm telling you how we went from hope to promise, right? And we're going to realize the promise. And then COVID landed on us. And it must be an opportunity too, but COVID landed on us and really showed ageism, okay? It showed that if you're 80 years old, you're 200 times more likely to die if you're 20 years old. Okay, it's really the major risk for dying. And by the way, multimorbidity, lots of diseases, for me, they're just how old but you are biologically. You know, at age 65, half of the people in Europe have less than two diseases, and the other half have more than two diseases. So they're not super agers. They're aging really quicker. Aging is the major risk factor for COVID. And this is because of something that happened to those hallmarks. The immunity declines, so the virus is more likely to attack you. And second, what the people die from, within a few days of the infection, they get a very big inflammatory response, uncontrolled, that is destructive, that is destroying the lung, and that is really causing the death. Those are two of the hallmarks of aging that can be targeted, actually. Both of them can be targeted. And we're trying to find a way for the public to know that, know what to do about it. This is just, I think, important insights on the hallmark. If you want something more specific, you can ask.
Okay. This episode of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is sponsored by Fastic. Before we had refrigeration, processing, and bulk transportation, we just didn't have access to food like we do today. because we're opportunistic eaters, most of us consistently eat more than we should, and our bodies don't know how to signal to us that we've had enough. I practice intermittent fasting regularly, and it's a strategy many of my clients use to get control of food, and as a happy side effect, lose weight. Fastic is an app you can download on an Apple or Android smartphone. It's a pretty snazzy app with a lot of tools to help you do intermittent fasting right. It not only lets you track your fasting, but water consumption, steps, and a lot of other things. You can also connect with a fasting buddy to help keep you even more accountable. If you have an iPhone, go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/iFastic. That's iFastic. For an Android, go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/aFastic. aFastic. If you're interested in learning more about intermittent fasting or just need some help getting started, go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/iFastic for an iPhone or 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/aFastic for an Android phone. No, that was wonderful because, you know, I think that really when I saw that picture, because you had a graphic in the book, you could see that interrelation, you know, and you did an excellent job there with COVID as an example of, you know, you've got two things. You've got the immune response and then you've got the inflammation in the body and how they're interrelated. So that was really good. You got into one topic that I thought was a little interesting. You know, being in the health space, I have a lot of friends that are in the health space, and I have one friend that was on metformin while he was diabetic. He reversed his diabetes and he got off of metformin, but he decided for personal reasons, longevity reasons, to start taking metformin again. Now he exercises, he rides his bike, he does a lot of different things. So he was already exercising, which was a benefit. But then when he started talking about metformin, I was like, okay, well, until I saw it in your book. So can you kind of talk about the benefits that we get from something like metformin or exercise?
Sure. Really interesting topic. And in fact, let me say, I have many interests in metformin, but it's all because of overwhelming interest. We are trying to do a study that will demonstrate to the FDA that aging can be targeted, and then variety of age-related diseases, not only one, but few, can be delayed substantially, okay? That aging is a preventable condition from age-related disease perspective. To thread this needle, we had to find a drug that does it, a drug that is available, a drug that doesn't have pharmaceutical about it because we are just scientists, and a drug that really will serve as a tool to pave the road, because the point is, if the FDA doesn't have indication to target aging, then healthcare providers don't have to pay for it. If healthcare providers are not paying for that, the pharmaceuticals are not going to jump in because they need a business plan. I realize that. So we needed to break that. And that's the geroscience effort and American Federation of Aging Research and the NIH now are all partners in the study that's called TAME, Targeting Aging with Metformin, in order to show that aging can be targeted. Okay, so that's the big picture, okay? Of course, you have to understand that because of that, I'm not selling metformin to anyone, okay? That's not the purpose, but I need to do the study in order to show that. But why metformin? Well, first of all, if you give metformin to almost all animals, most recently a fish, one of the fish that is in the lab now investigated, it's called killing fish, all other animals, you give them metformin, they live healthier and longer, okay? But in people, because, and by the way, metformin, just from a historical perspective, it's a drug that initially in the 40s of last century, okay, so 80 years ago, was used to prevent flu and malaria. In other words, somebody discovered the fact that it has some strong effects. While doing that, people also demonstrated that people who got metformin and had high glucose level, their glucose level normalized. And in fact, then it all became about diabetes, and it's the first drug of choice to treat type 2 diabetes, which is the major form of diabetes. So metformin is out there for more than 60 years. So everything you want to do, you know about metformin, we know about metformin. Okay, it's been around. There are currently almost 200 million people around the world that are on metformin. So it's generic. There's no pharmaceutical behind it. It's cheap. It's safe. Perfect tool for us. What is the evidence from humans? Well, if you take non-diabetic and give them metformin, you'll prevent diabetes in them. Okay, a big clinical study. It's called the DPP. Another big clinical studies were to look at the effects of metformin versus other drugs on prevention of cardiovascular disease in diabetes. Metformin prevented cardiovascular disease in diabetes. There's a many association study, hundreds of association studies, all showing that people on metformin have less cancers, all kinds of cancers. There's both clinical studies and association studies that there is less cognitive impairment and less Alzheimer's in people with metformin. And maybe the most fascinating to me is a huge study that was done in the UK, where in the UK you can go into the pharmacies and get data, you know, not the name of the person, but other medical information on those subjects. So they took like 170,000 people and took the 78,000 that are on metformin, did a control with age match people, you know, in the treated by the same doctors, getting subscription from the same pharmacies, and basically they showed that compared to non-diabetic, people with diabetes and metformin had much less mortality, 17% less mortality over 5 years of follow-up. Now, the people with more mortality had no diabetes, and the people on metformin had diabetes, they were more obese and more sick to start with, and yet they lived longer. So take everything I told you about metformin, and you see that it's a real drug that has real effect on many diseases, in a composite of diseases, and that's why we use it as a tool to get permission from the FDA to target aging with it.
Okay. Now we can get a similar effect with exercise, but in the book you kind of talked about using both of them together.
So, you know, so one of our challenges is we have all those hallmarks. Let's say we have a drug for all the hallmarks. Can we use all the combination together? Will it be additive? And the answer is it's specific. So we collaborated with a group that done the following study. They took elderly and they exercised them. Half of them were exercised with metformin and half of them without. And they actually, that was an NIH grant, and they predicted that metformin will be additive to the effect of exercise. But to their surprise, and by the way, there are other groups that showed the same, all the people that exercised did better, but the muscle of the ones that exercise was bigger than the muscle of those that exercised and were on metformin. So it looked like metformin was actually inhibiting the growth of the muscle. Okay? We were interested in that because in one of the supplements that you don't read, they also show something fascinating, that although the muscle was smaller, the strength was the same between two groups. Okay? So for me, it means per gram of muscle, The one on metformin is better. Okay, why is that? And what we did with this group, we got, they did biopsies before and after treatment of the people. And we looked at the transcript of the, of those biopsies, and we showed exactly the mechanism by which muscle growth with exercise and why and how it wasn't growing as much with mitochondria. It was totally fitting. But metformin increased 516 other transcripts that are more of the aging protective transcripts. Okay, so they affected autophagy, I said before, some other things. They decrease mTOR, some other things. And so at the end, you can choose. If you want to exercise because you want big muscle, don't take metformin. But what the metformin did is it didn't affect the force, but affected the aging of the muscle. So at the end, it had a similar functional effect, but you can choose what you want to do.
Yeah. And you know, that kind of falls in line. If you think about it, when we first started this conversation and we were talking about the growth factor and the hormones, and people will often take those hormones because they want to get a little bit more muscular, even as they age. And then here we are saying, you know, if you can build the quality strength of muscle without building that extra size, metformin will help you do that. And I guess the final one is, can I just
say something about it? Look, a lot of what growth hormone is doing, and for which, so you sell it in quite expensively, right? So why people are buying it? Because they see something. What they see, growth hormone melts fat under the skin, okay? That's why people seeing that something is happening. When it melts fat around your muscle look bulgier, okay? There's very few studies that shows any effect on strength, okay? Maybe there's a little bit, but it's not much at all.
Yeah, that's going to come with the testosterone where you're recovering a little faster, therefore you're working out more often. And that's typically where, you know, bodybuilders, they use either testosterone or steroid. That's where they see the size come from, is they're just able to train harder and longer and more often. And that's where they're getting
But you know, what you said is very important. So I want to use this opportunity. We're talking about 70 years old. We're not talking about bodybuilders below 40, okay? Yeah. So let's what I'm telling you is true for aging, okay? I'm not saying it's untrue for the others, but I'm not saying it's true either, okay? So let's just build a Chinese wall.
Yeah, and I think that's where I was going with this
Panama
whole...
Canal. I want to say Panama Canal.
And I think that's where I was going with this, is to say, you know, a lot of the things that we would be doing to, you know, build muscle and look more aesthetically pleasing are not necessarily going to be good for aging.
Exactly.
Okay. And one that I wanted to get into is I saw this this show, it's been years ago, and you name them, you call them cronies, but they're basically people that significantly undereat. And there's some science behind how undereating can and calorie restriction can allow you to live longer. We see that. We've seen a lot of that. But you talked about in the book ways that we can use things like intermittent fasting and ketosis to mimic that effect.
Right. So I want to say something about this paradigm. When we started caloric restriction, we knew another fact, that if you give zero calories, they'll all die in a few days, right? So we know that there are limits, okay? The question is how much calories, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that the cronies took the right amount of calories. I think they took less calories than what they should have. But for me, one of the things that that we've done that always has to go back to the science. Yeah, we did those caloric restriction everywhere, all the time, and it was always successful, okay? And whenever I test a drug that might affect aging, One of the control groups is the caloric restricted animal, right? But what we did with the caloric restricted animal is the following. We would come in the morning. Okay, they were hungry. We would put all the food in the morning. So they would eat all the food in the morning and will fast for 23 hours more. Okay, we really, okay, because we said, oh, you know what caloric restriction means? It means that less for breakfast, less for lunch, less for dinner. But that's not what we did to the animal. When we started actually doing the caloric restriction throughout the day, they were thinner, but they didn't live longer, which means something in this fasting is important for the benefits of caloric restriction.
Now, do you think that has something to do with, you know, with cell death and the body's reusing of materials a bit more efficiently?
Well, we're looking at what happens in this time course of fasting. So we're taking young and old people, men and women, and we're trying to look what happens to the biology of aging. We're going to take their cells and see at which time they become younger, right? We are going to see in the plasma, when are the ketones starting to go up? When is the insulin going down and all that? And really determine, because look, first of all, if all it takes is 12 hours, then more people will be able to do 12 hours. They'll just skip lunch, right? The 16-8 hours, which is what I'm doing, is just surprisingly easy. All you do is skip breakfast. And you know that in 16 hours, you can have whatever you want. And you're not limited, although you find out that you eat less, but you're not limited. And I think this is a big advantage. If you gave me a diet for 3 months, I could fail any day. I could break any day. But I'm not going to break if I have 2 hours to go. I'm just not going to break. Okay, so that's easy. And another thing, you lose weight quite rapidly initially. Then it stabilized, but you lose weight. So yeah, it's a good diet.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the point. You know, when I get into ketosis, which I'm approaching right now, I naturally stop wanting to eat breakfast. You know, just when I wake up, I'm not hungry. That's a very productive period of time for me. So even stopping to eating, because it's quiet, you know, I get up about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And so I have about 4 hours before any emails are coming in or anything else is going on. And those are the most productive hours of my day. So I don't want to stop and eat then. I want to wait, you know, till the emails start coming in. Then I can eat my breakfast while I'm reading email. But you know, I think there's a lot to this, and I appreciate that you're taking the time to study, you know, how all these different protocols and in some cases now we're going to say medications can target aging, because again, we don't want to just get older. We want to have a long healthy life too. So try to get that biological age lower than our chronological age. Doctor, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are 3 strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Oh, well, first of all, I agree with this definition. You know, with my book, I'm not trying to sell any medication, although I have a lot of comments on many of those, and not only on medication, on stress, on society, on interaction. I mean, boy, the older people are so lonely with this COVID-19. They're just so lonely. There's so many things that are part of health span. And it's not only medical. It's emotional. It's everything. What I'm trying to do is really to say something else. I'm sorry, I'm not, you can ask me specifically, but I'm trying to do something else in my book. I'm trying to say there's a lot of information out there. Okay, here, we're going to have information out there. How do you know what's real, what's marketing, what was proven, what was hope, what is totally fake? Okay, it's very difficult. And I'm saying, look, I'm impressed only when I see a clinical study. A clinical study means you take a population, half of them are on a drug, half of them are in placebo, They don't know, the doctors don't know, and we have an outcome that we calculated. We know how many people we need and how much time we need. And this is a clinical study. And that's the only way that you can be sure that you're doing the right thing. And unfortunately, there are not that many of them. I brought as an example vitamin D. Vitamin D is associated with every disaster in the world, okay? But just the same, except women with osteoporosis, every time you give vitamin D to people in risk, almost nothing happens, or very little happens. The effect of vitamin D seems huge, and when you give vitamin D, almost nothing happens, or very little happens. So there's no compelling reason. By the way, I have low vitamin D level. My doctor wanted me to take the vitamin D, and I said, show me. And he said, well, maybe if you have osteoporosis. I said, let's do a scan. I did a scan. I actually have bones that are 5 Z's thicker than the average. And I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe that's why I have low vitamin D level, because we might not know all the interaction. Maybe the fact that my bone is like that, it decreases the conversion of vitamin D because it needs protection. So I don't need to build bone. Okay. So for me, vitamin D is not an issue because the clinical studies have not supported it. There is another part of vitamin D, though, that I would give as an example. If you want to take vitamins, at least vitamin D didn't show to be harm. So that's also good. So, we can go one by one. But then there's another category. There's a category of drugs that have promise, okay, based on lots of data, maybe animals' data, but there's no clinical study, and maybe there won't be clinical study. You know, there are nutraceuticals, okay? So in that, and one of the examples is NMA, NAD supplement, NMN. So I don't have anything against taking NMN. I think I don't understand everything. We don't understand everything we need to know about NMN, but it probably has strong anti-aging properties. And I don't see really that it's doing harm. Although I'm not in absolute way sure of that either. Okay, are they good in people who have cancer? Maybe it's not good in people who have cancer. Okay, there are lots of safety issues that we could deal. But the point really that I'm trying to stress is we have to do better than just reading something in the internet and taking it. Much better than that. And there is a way to make progress in that.
Yes. Well, doctor, thank you so much. If someone wanted to learn more about you, learn more about the book, Age Later, where would you like for me to send them?
So Age Later can be bought in Amazon. And if you want to have more information about the book and about health, the American Federation of Aging Research, AFAR.com or .org, I'm now confused. One of them is where you can find more about the book.
Okay. You can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/449, and I'll be sure to have the links there. So Dr. Barzilai, thank you so much for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
A pleasure. Good luck to you and nice mission to have.
Thank you. As always, thank you so much for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness. I'm really glad you were here today and hope you enjoyed that interview. You may not know this, but I love big round numbers. And the next episode of the 40 Plus Fitness podcast is Big Bold 450. Can you believe it? I will be doing a solo show where I share some personal anecdotes about a recent fail I experienced and how it made me a better person and a better coach. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.